Thanks for dropping along tonight at the Sydney Institute, and thanks to King & Wood Mellisons for the use of this fine facility. Angus Taylor makes a first-up appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's well known to all of you, I guess, so I'll introduce him very briefly. He had honours degrees in economics and law at the University of Sydney, a Master of Philosophy from Oxford. He was a Rhodes Scholar. He worked in business for many years, and since 2013, the member for Hume, and currently, in recent times, the Assistant Minister for Cities and Digital Transformation. But tonight, Mr. Taylor is going to talk to the Institute on the topic Democracy in Deficit, Why Reform in the New South Wales Liberal Party is Necessary for Future Electoral Success. Angus Taylor, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you to you and the Sydney Institute, of course, for hosting me here this evening. I've come to many events over the years, and it's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to actually speak here. And of course, can I acknowledge the many luminaries in the room, including the former Senator Michael Bohm. I'm sure there are other former or current politicians in the room, but it is great to have an audience, many of whom I know. So it's wonderful to have you here. Tonight, I will call for the revitalisation of the New South Wales Liberal Party. In this speech, I'll seek to take a good, honest look at the current state of our party in New South Wales and, by extension, across the country. I argue that we need to revitalise and democratise the party in New South Wales, and we need to take meaningful steps in that direction immediately. I'll also argue that our electoral success depends on this. What I'm calling for tonight isn't unique and has been well and truly on the agenda for many years, long before the 2014 Howard Report. That report, embarrassingly, has been collecting dust since it was written, as have many reports over the years. There has been a great deal of dust collected on this issue over many years, extending right back into the 1980s. Now, I'm motivated to speak on this topic because I believe that the success of our great party in New South Wales depends on what I'm proposing. But I think it's also a question for the prosperity of our wonderful nation. This issue of revitalisation and democratisation in New South Wales is a matter of broader public impact and importance, because I think it will have an impact on the Liberal and Conservative movements around the country. We need the Liberal Party to prevail in these times. The country can't succumb to inward-looking, populist, leftist identity politics, which are currently getting a pretty good run here and around the world. If we can't stand for and prevail in our quest for economic and political freedoms in efficient but competent government, if the nation can't stay grounded in these very basic values, then we may as well pack up and go home. Now, I have absolutely no intention of packing up and going home, because I believe that the Liberal Party's best times are ahead of it if we confront the challenges that we face. Of course, the New South Wales division is the largest and most influential in the country, and it has been very successful in recent years, and we should celebrate that success at all times. But like any successful organisation, we face challenges, and the truth is that if the New South Wales Liberal division sneezes, the Federal Party catches a cold. If we don't face up to the serious challenges and quickly, then we face electoral failure. To be sure of winning elections in the future, we need a reinvigorated division with a motivated membership, with foot soldiers in our electorates taking us up every day, or backing us up and talking us up every day, with more troops on the hustings than ever before. Now, before I talk more about what I have in mind and why these changes are so important, I want to flag some personal context. My interest in reform in the New South Wales Liberal Party isn't recent. Well before I decided to run for pre-selection in Hume, I took the view that there were two ways for me to make a difference in politics. I remember discussing this at length with my wife Louise about 10 years ago, and I said to her I could try to get into the Parliament and become a representative, or alternatively, I could commit myself to reforming the party through the organisational wing. I ventured to suggest that I could probably have more impact over a decade or more by working to reform the organisational wing. She was aghast at that. She thought it was an odd thing to say. Being a lawyer, she instinctively thinks that all really good things are done in public, like in a courtroom. She couldn't get her head around the proposition that seriously effective, meaningful work can be done by fixing the organisational, well, fixing organisational problems as opposed to making speeches in Parliament. But as someone who had spent my entire professional career advising on all manner of organisations and how to improve them, I learnt that enormous impact comes from building and nurturing institutions, often behind the scenes. Unhealthy organisations only last so long. Positive internal health in an organisation, whether it's a company, a partnership, an NGO, a start-up, a cooperative, a sports club, and yes, a political party, enables its flag bearers to go out in public and strut their stuff, to explain and advocate for their organisations and its goals. So the strength of an organisation always, always provides the platform for success in the public space. In any event, rightly or wrongly, I decided to go into Parliament thinking that I could leave it to others to reform the party. I could never have dreamed that 2 years into my first parliamentary term, things in the New South Wales division would be such that my own pre-selection for the 2016 election would be seriously challenged despite an enormously strong supporter base across my electorate, many of whom are here this evening. I survived, but I'm not here to tell that story. It's important to highlight that I came into politics as an outsider. I wasn't involved in student politics. I'd never worked as a staffer or at a think tank like the Institute. I was very fortunate in 2012 to be pre-selected with broad-based support, but that was largely because Hume was a rural seat with very traditional rural branches. I'd worked almost full-time for around a year with the support of Albie Schultz, Bill Heffernan, and others like Peter Seaton here in this room. And I made contact with every branch member many times over. I took the view that I should treat my pre-selection as though it was a plebiscite. Now, as a result of a recent redistribution and a small group gaining a stranglehold at the northern end of Hume, an outsider like me would not be pre-selected again. Would not be pre-selected again, no matter how much work he or she did. The point is that the problems I could so clearly see before I went into Parliament have not been fixed and have arguably got worse. Now, to bring this to life, I propose to tell one simple story from my own experience beyond the one I've already described. The story, I think, highlights much of what anyone needs to know about the challenge we face. It's not the only example I could give. There are others, but it's a simple story about a branch in my electorate, or more accurately, a branch that was not to be. Branches are, of course, or at least should be, a good thing for any member of Parliament. They're a mainstay of our support in the community. Regular meetings enhance camaraderie between supporters and make members aware of what, or members of the branch, aware of what their MP is doing or their candidate is doing. The branch members provide MPs with invaluable feedback. Crucially, they go out into their communities and they barrack for you. In essence, a properly functioning branch plugs its representative into the local community, and without doubt, it makes a material difference on the ground. So for parliamentarians and candidates, it should be that the more branches and the more members, the better. So when I set out on my quest for pre-selection in the old Hume boundaries, I found that the branch structure in some parts of the electorate was weaker than they should have been. So I consciously and actively built up support across the electorate. During this time, I identified a handful of communities where branches would be beneficial and realisable, in large part because people had asked me about joining the party and establishing a branch. I had many conversations, and I ascertained there were requisite members to form a branch in a number of places, and I had a sense of who would be the main players in each branch and I encouraged them to enlist others. I was also aware that opening a branch was not straightforward in New South Wales. Having the willing supporters signed up and ready to go doesn't mean it can be formed. Senior players in the party then and now can often find a way to directly or indirectly veto the opening of new branches. To maximise chances of success and avoid disappointment, I decided to start off in the good town of Cowra. Now, why Cowra? Well, Cowra was the furthest distance from the headquarters, the secretariat of the New South Wales Liberal Party in my electorate. It was my assessment that a far-flung Cowra branch would pose less concern to the good and the great of the party, whatever their concerns might be, and therefore had the best prospects of succeeding. It had also recently been a National Party stronghold, and I needed a Liberal Party presence. So the idea was to get Cowra opened, and then other branches could follow. I knew that if I couldn't get this one off the ground, then it would be far more difficult to get any others off the ground. Now, for arcane reasons that I won't go into, I needed to obtain approval from State Executive to move recently signed up members living in and around Cowra into this new branch. It was to be full of classic country Liberals. Tradies, small business owners, farmers, retirees, some former National Party members, country doctors and solicitors. There could not be a group of people who looked more like country Liberals. And none of them would have known a power broker if they'd fallen over them. Now, you're all guessing by now where this story ends. The application was rejected by the State Executive. Informally, I was told that there was concern that the branch would be stacked with factional operators. Now, this may well have been a genuinely held concern on the State Executive who voted no, because I understand what they're used to seeing. But there was, in fact, no prospect of this occurring. Cowra, as you know, is a long way from here, and if power brokers had shown an interest in joining the Cowra branch, the metaphorical shotguns would have come out. Those country Liberals would simply not have tolerated. This was a turning point for me. At that point, I switched from being a polite, private supporter of party reform to committing myself to bringing it about. I had wasted valuable time and effort in trying to get the branch established and other branches established. Worse, the rejection of the application was embarrassing for me amongst my supporters and, in my view, embarrassing for the party. Former National Party members who were now my supporters were astounded by all of this. If I, a hard-working member, a new member of the Federal Parliament, who had come into the Parliament to do good work for the people of Hume and the people of Australia, who had no interest in shenanigans of any kind, had no clear capacity to build my local support base, had no clear capacity because of this decision to build my support base by forming genuine, properly functioning branches full of good country Liberals, then something was wrong in the state of Denmark. It was and is an absolutely untenable situation. As it stands, I have in my electorate dinky dire real people in different places wanting to join the party. Some are prevented from joining existing nearby branches which won't accept new members. Others would like to start up new branches, including one here in this room, to get around the rejection of membership applications. But for various reasons, it's just too hard to get these new branches up and running. It's also been true that the State Executive did, in recent years, approve opening of what are known as paper branches. These branches are controlled by power brokers whose members rarely attend meetings, but they create voting delegates whose votes can be controlled. The control over who can and cannot open branches, with many of them being tightly controlled and managed, provides a line of command and control from the State Executive right through to the organisational party. There is a sense amongst many in the ordinary membership that their concerns are a second-order priority in this extremely centralised hierarchy. Now, it is important to acknowledge some counterpoints. First, none of these concerns are completely new. None of them are new at all, even if the urgency of the need for the change has intensified, and I'll come back to that. And no so-called faction has clean hands. You don't need to be a student of Shakespeare or House of Cards to know that most human beings tend towards self-interest, particularly when faced with the question of acquiring and preserving power. Second, I don't suggest for a second that any person on the state executive is wrongly motivated. In organisations where the incentives for advancement are dysfunctional, skewed narratives develop. The narratives are honestly held, but they justify conduct that isn't in the best interest of the organisation. A wise outsider can immediately see how patently wrong the narrative is, but it's strongly asserted and protected by incumbents because it's what they're used to. Now, I've seen this many times in so many organisations, public and private. I've no doubt that many of those who are against party reform quite honestly hold the view that we are doomed if reform occurs. But in my respectful opinion, they are wrong. Now, whether you agree with party reform or not, I don't think anyone can seriously contest the proposition that the effect of all this is to discourage some good Liberal supporters from joining the party. No one can seriously argue that current settings strongly encourage recruitment of good Liberals and formation of new bona fide branches. And those settings encourage purely political behaviour with no flow-on benefits for electoral success or good policy. It doesn't really matter why this is happening or who started it. There's no point blaming one group or another. It just needs to change. The size and energy of our membership base has depleted and we're not replenishing it. Many of our members and supporters are getting cynical and fed up. Quite simply, we're not putting our best foot forward. So the answer to these problems, I think, is not new, and many have suggested solutions. I'm firmly and unapologetically in the camp that thinks the starting point is to allow party members who genuinely reside in an electorate to vote in pre-selections in that electorate. It's an important step to shifting power and energy back to the grassroots of the party. The more members we have and the more members have voting, who have voting rights on important questions, the harder it will be for anyone to control the outcomes. It will be a virtuous cycle. Many whose views and long experience counts, whether it be the Premier, former Prime Ministers Howard and Abbott, Senator Sinodinos and many, many others, including many in this room, have indicated their agreement with this. So this is hardly genius. Calling for a bit of democracy in a mainstream political party in one of the world's great democracies is not a radical idea. It's not exactly an affront to our political instincts. What's more, the decentralisation of power is central to Liberal and Conservative philosophy. It's one of the ways we like to distinguish ourselves from our centralising left-wing opponents. In our party, efforts to move power from the centre to the membership should be embraced as obvious, fundamental and axiomatic. Nor is it new. It's not as if we'd be embarking on a scary, bold experiment where the consequences are unknown. The reforms that I'm calling for and others are calling for have occurred elsewhere in Australia and in Conservative parties around the world, including the UK and Canada. Look at our neighbours in Victoria. The implementation of plebiscites in that division has not resulted in conferences being overtaken by particular groups, by religious extremists or ethnic clans. Victoria has produced two outstanding groups of new parliamentarians based on plebiscites, including Josh Frydenberg, Kelly O'Dwyer, Alan Tudge, Dan Tehan, Julia Banks, Tim Wilson and James Patterson. No one can argue with the quality of those outcomes. We should also take a good look at our coalition partner, the Nationals, which has been far more democratic for some time. This, and I've seen it myself many times over, gives them enormous advantage in regional and rural areas, and I think we saw some of that advantage at the last election. Despite facing the demographic challenges of older and disengaged populations in many of their seats, their membership base is surprisingly energetic and robust. I think this is directly attributable to their much flatter, more democratic party structure, which gives members a vital say in the goings-on of the party, including pre-selections. So addressing another counterpoint, it's true serious change in any organisation is never plain sailing. Not everything goes to plan. There will be some pain, and it's quite possible that some may be worse off. I'm the first to acknowledge that the current system in New South Wales has produced some outstanding MPs and senators. There is, of course, as everyone knows, serious talent within our ranks. But talented, hard-working MPs in New South Wales should not be concerned about a stronger membership. They have nothing to fear because history shows that plebiscites clearly reward talent and merit, strongly favouring incumbency. So why do we need to act with urgency? Well, the frank answer is the electoral cycle. In a couple of years, at both state and federal levels, we're heading into elections for third terms. Our stocks are not what they were when we were first elected. We can't wait for a couple of plebiscite pilots in two or three seats prior to the next election, as is the current plan. Nor is it enough for a few senior politicians in safe seats to volunteer plebiscites in their seats, worthy as those gestures are. It simply won't cut the mustard. We need to lower the drawbridge and show the Australian people we have as much faith in their involvement in the party as we do their involvement at the ballot box. We need genuine plebiscites in this short to medium term in all seats, but prior to the next election, as a minimum, we need plebiscites to elect candidates in all marginal seats. We need time to build up our membership base in these seats, get candidates on the ground, working in their communities with their supporters, working hard and barracking for their victory. Beyond that, we need to entrench plebiscites in all seats across New South Wales. There's another reason, perhaps a more important reason, that the time has come to get moving on this straight away. Let me cut to the chase. At the federal election, we lost seats in New South Wales that were vulnerable to dynamics we're now seeing in the UK through Brexit and the US via Trump. It's clear, it's very clear, that in Australia and throughout the Western world, there's increasing cynicism about the political class and politicians generally. The representatives of major parties in all Western democracies personify the political class. The perception is that we are the establishment, the elite. We are perceived as self-serving and arrogant. We are seen as people who make promises and don't deliver. We are not seen as people who share the frustrations of the ordinary people. Now, we all know that in many ways the caricature is untrue, I think, and even unfair at many levels. Much extraordinary good work is ignored. But the cynicism is perpetuated. Minor parties and independents who have an interest in undermining the success of the major parties are contributing to this, and we can't possibly blame them for that. If we are honest, though, we must accept some of the blame. The cynicism is much stronger in the outer suburbs and the regional centres. And I see this in my own electorate. Some of these voters feel that they have not been sharing in the extraordinary wealth generated in the knowledge economies right around the world. Their homes are not increasing in value as much as in the inner suburbs, whilst younger people are struggling to get into the housing market at all. In many areas, like the fringes of southwestern Sydney, which I represent, many feel like they're battling all the time. As they chase higher paid jobs closer to the city, they feel that they spend their lives commuting. If they own small businesses, they feel like they're constantly dealing with red tape imposed by governments. Some are resentful, not because they're poor, they're not, but because they just can't get ahead. Contrast that with what demographer John Black refers to as goat's cheese suburbs. These suburbs are closer to the CBDs and full of people who have done well out of the knowledge economy, as I have, and I'm very lucky to have had those opportunities, and who stand to do well in the future. Here in Sydney, many of the goat's cheese suburbs are the richest suburbs in the country, of course. The voters' homes are in many cases worth small fortunes. If they don't own the homes, they're in rental accommodation close to the city because they are higher-end professionals and they can afford it. The new divide is not so much between the haves and the have-nots, but between insiders and outsiders. The divide separates the goat cheese suburbs from the cheddar cheese communities, and it is relatively new. It's gaining traction here and right throughout the Western world. After the election, not long after the election, in the few days that followed it, being vitally interested in the outer suburbs and regional cities, I ran a little bit of analysis. I found that swings against Liberal seats with high number of central business district workers who lived worked in the centre of the cities. I think Wentworth, Mackellar, North Sydney and Bradfield. Those swings were small when compared with seats with far fewer CBD workers. John Black, who I mentioned earlier, has captured this beautifully. He found that the swing against the coalition in the wealthier, better educated, what he called goat and cheese suburbs, was only 1%, less than 1%. The swing against us was less than 1%. In contrast, the swing against the coalition in suburbs with middle-income families with higher numbers of swinging voters was just under 6%. 1% versus 6%. Likewise, for the regions where manufacturing is in decline, characterised by lower-income working families, his words, not mine, similarly, 1% versus 6%. Now, it's pretty obvious these results present a problem for us in the current climate. In New South Wales, the Liberal brand has suffered. We're now firmly seen as in the insiders' club. Whether it's right or wrong, fair or unfair, is absolutely beside the point. The narrative is strong, and it plays right into the feeling that politics is all about us, not them. So what does all of this have to do with party reform? Well, I hope it's obvious. There has never been a time when mainstream political parties have been perceived to be more out of touch, not just in Australia, as I said, but around the world. And if we're to survive now and in the future, we need to address this. Labor has foot soldiers, and they know how to mobilise them. They are much better grassroots campaigners than we are. They enlist their union members, teachers and nurses. They have more people door knocking, phone canvassing and putting up call flutes. They perpetuate ugly lies in any way they can, including through third parties like GetUp. They have had huge success with their grassroots campaigns in Queensland, Victoria and, of course, in the last federal election. And whilst we did win, and we should celebrate the fact that we won, and this is a point that has been lost on Labor, it was not by much. Anyone who stood on a booth in Western and southwestern Sydney on election day, as I did, felt the pain, and it's a pain that few of us will forget. Now, I'm not suggesting that democratisation is a panacea. We won't wake up and find that electoral success is guaranteed. Much more is required. We do need to look at how we prevent dishonest phone canvassing and text messages. We do need to address unprecedented queues at polling booths, providing endless opportunities for Labor booth workers to perpetuate their lies. We do need to address and deliver on policies that will open up opportunities for all Australians, including those in our regional centres and outer suburbs. We clearly need to build tougher, more assertive campaign machines in each electorate. We simply cannot go to the next state and federal elections in New South Wales without a much more engaged membership than we currently have. So we have no choice but to embrace democratisation as a catalyst for that renewed engagement. Now, organisations are made up of human beings, and human beings, when drawn together in a common cause, rarely agree on how to define the cause, let alone how to execute it. But the best organisations constantly look for ways to iron out the wrinkles of dysfunction and to operate at their very best. The task is always perpetual. Leaders have to be vigilant, must keep the objectives and goals of the organisation firmly in sight, must be open to criticism, and must be prepared to address weakness. There must always be preparedness to change. When things are broken, they have to be fixed. As a broad church and as a mainstream party, it's inevitable and in fact healthy that we debate policies and their execution. However, we have to all agree on our collective political imperative to hold on to government so that our broader values can continue to advance this nation's prosperity and security. If we're committed to that objective here and around the nation, we have a responsibility to address the democracy deficit in New South Wales and to address it now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Angus Taylor, for an important address. So we come to questions and discussion. Before we do, thanks again to King and Wood Mellisons for the use of this facility this evening. Now, as you know, Mr. Taylor, four Liberals have led the Liberal Party to government from opposition since the party was formed. the late Robert Menzies, the late Malcolm Fraser, John Howard and Tony Abbott. Now, if John Howard and Tony Abbott can't achieve reform in the New South Wales branch of the Liberal Party, how can you?
Well, first of all, I would like to think that they're collaborators in this important objective. But I think the important point I would make on this, Gerard, is that the urgency is greater than it has ever been. I think we now have a very clear burning platform, more than ever. We have been able to win recent state and federal elections without democratising. I think it's going to be very difficult to continue winning elections without democratising. And that's the key point. Having spent many, many years driving change through organisations in my previous work before politics, I always felt that there was a perfect moment for change in any organisation. The right moment for change, and I think we now have the right moment for change.
There's a question here. No, everyone's got to be brief. A lot of people here. Yep.
Could we bring in what Queensland did in 2006, which was link electoral funding to proof of intra-party democracy, both for officials as well as for politicians?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what you've got in mind there, Carolyn, but look, I think our biggest imperative isn't electoral funding reform. I think our biggest imperative is energising our base, energising our membership, involving our membership in the party, in its policies, and, of course, in voting for its representatives. And that has to be a very clear focus. If we keep that clear focus, I think we can actually achieve it.
Angus, Tim Jones, great address. Thanks very much. At the end of the last election, I'll just tell you a brief story. We were packing away the A-frames. I declared my 23-year-long membership of the Liberal Party, putting away the A-frames. And someone jokingly said, next campaign, don't worry about the A-frames. We'll need more Zimmer frames. Now, sad but true, this is an ageing party, and you're quite right, we're not replenishing. So democracy is part of that, but it's just one part of that. What are the many other parts of re-energising and replenishing our party ranks?
Look, I think you have to think about democratisation as a catalyst. And certainly as I speak to the Victorians and others who have been through this process, the very clear message that comes across is use this as a catalyst. Use it as an opportunity to re-engage, to change the way you engage with your membership, to recruit. And, I have to be honest, I think the Labor Party have used their push towards democratisation, is not necessarily in the form that I'm proposing here tonight, but they've used their push towards democratisation as an extraordinary catalyst to energise their base, and we need to do the same. So if it is just democratisation alone, it's not enough. This must be a catalyst for a broader change and mobilisation of good, strong Liberals across New South Wales.
Michael? Angus, in your statement about the timing and how the time is now right, I'm intrigued you didn't mention in your talk that the current situation, which has developed where lobbyists now control pre-selections of people who they then have the opportunity of approaching once they become members of Parliament on behalf of paid clients.
No, I understand that point, Michael. And look, in many ways, I think it's just extremely important if we're going to achieve this that we just stay very focused on the overriding consideration, which is to give our membership base more say in the party, in its representatives. And I think a lot of those other things will follow as we do that. I think that will naturally follow. So I think when you think about organisational change, you've always got to look for the one or two things that are really going to drive everything else, and I think this is it. It's not to say there aren't other things that need addressing, as you suggest.
Question here. Hi, Angus. Alex Law. Firstly, can I say I agree with everything that you've said. My question is, if reform occurs, how do we prevent... I mean, you're the exception in terms of federal parliamentarians because you're a hard worker, you stand up for policy in your electorates and your constituents. My question is, how are we going to compete if you're an outsider, for example, with the insider federal parliamentarians who get all their staff to basically oppose you in a seat, for example. So how is the outsider going to compete if they've got a federal parliamentarian with all their staff stacking out branches and working on these same members that they get to win?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think one of the advantages of sitting in the federal parliament when looking at this is you get to see a range of different systems even within Australia. There are many different systems across the world, of course, but I get to speak to my colleagues in other states. And I mentioned the large number of Victorian MPs who have been pre-selected through plebiscites in the last two election cycles, very, very good people. They will all tell you, bar none, they will all tell you that these are fiercely and fairly contested pre-selections, fiercely and fairly contested in a way that we simply don't see in New South Wales on many occasions. And that I think ultimately it comes down to, you know, do you believe in decentralising and democratising and the good benefits that flow from it? Centrally planned systems feel as though they should be able to deliver wonderful outcomes, but the truth is we know from not hundreds but thousands of years of human experience that it just doesn't work that way. And so we've ultimately got to have faith that the sort of outcomes that we've seen in Victoria and in many other parts of Australia and the world will play out here, and I'm confident they will.
David Miles? Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Assistant Minister. That was a very powerful presentation. How many parliamentarians in the coalition party room would really feel strongly and enthusiastic about the way you presented the problems?
Well, I'm sure some will and some won't. I can tell you that my Victorian colleagues all feel very strongly about these sorts of changes because they've seen them and they've seen the benefits flow from them. I mean, and you only have to look at the result of the last election. Yes, there were other things going on in Victoria, but I also firmly believe, and they tell me, that the strength of their base was a big factor in their performance at the last election. Within New South Wales, of course, there are some of us who strongly believe in this, and I know there are some who are more reticent. I think we just need to keep making the case. Ultimately, though, what it comes down to is, do we want to position ourselves to win the next state and federal election? And if we don't, then, you know, do as you wish. But I do want to win the next state and federal election. And I think this is extremely important to achieve it. I don't think there is a single MP or senator in New South Wales who thinks that we have no work to do in terms of re-energising and reinvigorating our supporter base.
David?
To follow up from Jared's earlier question, I mean, the great speech, I agree with you entirely, as you know. How is this actually going to get done? You've got a state executive that doesn't want it. You've got a state president who steadfastly refuses to leave the position despite being a member of parliament. You've got a state council that has been stacked up the wazoo to ensure that the votes never pass. It's been put to them recently and stopped with the fake olive branch of a pilot program. I mean, I know we reformed the Senate. We didn't say we're just going to do it in Tassie first. You know, you do it everywhere if you're going to do it. And we've also got every state bar two that have got plebiscites as well. Yeah. We don't need a pilot. But how, I'm with you, whatever you want me to do, mate, I'm with you. How can we get it done?
Yeah, look, the starting point is that we've got to have a group of people who are going to go after this. I mean, the reason I have spoken out is that I know a large number of people within the party and within the parliament think that this needs to happen. And so someone needs to get out and start mobilising those who think the change needs to happen. We shouldn't be frightened of debate in this party. We believe in open and free speech and open and robust debate. That is one of the bedrocks of the Liberal Party. It's a strength and occasionally a weakness, but it is part of what we are. And I am confident, and I've seen it so many times before, that robust and strong debate does ultimately get you there. But we do have some changed circumstances. We have a Premier who is offering to do this in his own seat. That has never happened before. We have a former Prime Minister who has made his views very clear on this recently. Two, actually, two former prime ministers, one who wrote a report and one who made his views very clear on this. And I think a deep understanding that if we don't make some change in the near future, we're taking a very bigger risk with the next two elections, state and federal elections.
Question here.
Melody Mathewson, a lot of the media would know me.
Okay, just get... Okay.
I helped John Howard and Tony Abbott get into power. And because Tony Abbott was ousted the way he was, a lot of people, while I was campaigning for him, said that they weren't going to vote Liberal this election, and there were 9% of people that didn't vote at all, and also people are unlikely to support the New South Wales Party financially. If they don't see what they want to have done, what do you see as the future of the party if there isn't democracy? Do you see it going downhill the way it is?
The Liberal Party has survived a long while without democracy, but I think it's getting harder and harder. I think that's the truth. The world is changing. That's why other countries and other states have changed. Victoria did it reasonably painlessly. We've seen big changes in Canada, in the UK, in democratisation, and there is no doubt in each of those cases it has had very strong benefits. Look, if we don't do it, obviously we face far greater risks than if we do, and that's why, particularly at this time where we are seeking third terms within a few months of each other, that's what we're going to see the next time around. I mean, we have to have an active supporter base, because the scheduled elections at state and federal level will be within a few months of each other. I don't know which side will be which, in 2019 or thereabouts. And so if we don't act now, they are going to be a pretty harrowing period of time for Liberals in New South Wales.
Question here.
Thanks for your address, Assistant Minister. Two phenomena that you mentioned. One is the top-heavy nature of the organisation and decision-making. Another one along the way, you mentioned an obsession with identity politics and such issues. Are those two things related? Is the structure actually creating those obsessions and allowing them to flourish?
Well, when I was talking about identity politics, I was talking actually about the left of politics, not the Liberal Party. I was talking about the Labor Party. But I do think what you get with very centralised structures is elitist policy and elitist politics. And my point is that just as we need to get back to the grassroots, we need to recognise that the same people who do back us in elections when we win, and it is incredibly important that we get back to those basic fundamental values that get us elected. And identity politics is clearly not part of that. Now, I think it does enormous damage to the Labor Party too, because I think the same group of people who, frankly, are absolutely necessary for us to get elected are the same. They're obviously the same group Labor needs to get elected. And, you know, they're the people in Western Sydney and in our regional centres, and I don't think identity politics plays well to any of them. But I do think that decentralised structures are far more likely to succeed in winning those people over.
You've got to be brief. Yep.
I do think that the Mayor showed himself indifferent to the opinions of many ordinary Australians when he banned the Great Unrest in New South Wales.
Well, I think a question on that is... I think that you can answer if you want. I think that's a bit off the topic of what we're discussing tonight.
It shows indifference to...
Okay, look, okay, we're talking about this matter here. Okay, there's a question there. Jay, up the back.
Hello, Angus, thank you very much. My name's Jay Basick. I'm not the youngest person here, obviously, but I am maybe the youngest member of the Liberal Party. I joined... Is there anybody who can beat 2 weeks? No. And I joined the party because I was astonished at obviously, as Gough would say, I'm a fellow traveller, but I was astonished at the appalling result. It's all right to say we won by one and a field goal wins a game, but I don't think anybody here would have thought that what happened at the election was satisfactory. And when something goes wrong in an organisation, you want to be able to see the people involved say, here's what we think went wrong. I'm still waiting for that. And because I'm not a member of the party, maybe I've missed an internal memo somewhere that's been circulated amongst you. I joined the party after the election because I want to be one of the people who makes the changes that are necessary. And to start with, what you're saying tonight makes sense to me. I'm just wondering whether there's an opportunity, and I don't know the executive, I just met the president of the local branch here tonight. Is there an opportunity for people to become a sort of a ginger group within, under the umbrella, inside the tent, not outside the tent, that could say, here are the things that we're looking for, we want some answers, and we've got some questions, and we've got some capacity to give ourselves towards making changes? Is that doable?
I don't think we need a ginger group. I think the reality is that the vast majority of Liberal Party supporters out there, whether members or non-members, would think, if it was put to them, that every member having a vote in pre-selections and having that grassroots support is a good thing. And in fact, I think part of the answer to the earlier question we had about how we actually achieved this is just tap into that supporter base. That's how people feel. Look, the younger generation now, their idea of voting is watching a reality TV show and hitting a button on their iPhone. So the notion that they vote for someone who votes for someone who votes for someone else is just absurd. It's an absurdity in this modern era. And so I think we just have to tap into people's common sense. I don't think we need a ginger group. I think we've got a group there, which is a large group of members of the Liberal Party and certainly a large group of supporters who might otherwise be members who are prepared to stand up and say that they think this is the right thing.
Question over here.
Stuart Kompok. Just like to tell a little story, if I may indulge.
A brief one.
Very, very brief. In about 2000, I ran for president of the Liberal Party. I was unaligned, I was quite crazy, but I was very angry what was going on. So I put out a little card, a little postcard, which simply said, members matter the most. The executive stopped the presidential campaign, the presidential campaign, for a year. When they eventually, the vote was eventually took, I got 13%, so I was reminded of the vote by a state minister. In about 3 years after that, about 13% of individuals were literally wiped out of state council. The factions took over entirely. So I go back to what David Miles had to say. How do you do this? And I put to you, I'll make this a question. If you go back to what Sir Robert Menzies did, we are in exactly the same spot. We have lobbyists and all the stuff that's been talked about. If you look at the similarity, it's amazing how it's there.
Yeah.
You need to look at what Menzies did.
Yeah.
You need to understand what he said, because the language might be slightly different, but the principles haven't changed.
Yeah.
And it's going to take time to get people to understand, yes, there is hope, and we've got to trust the process, and then literally blow apart the executive, and that's where the fun's going to be. Because it's a constitution, we can't break it very easily. Have you thought about these things?
Yeah, look, there is a long debate we can have, and there's people like Walter Villatoro up the back of the room. I know I've been thinking about this for a long while and the history of it. It's great to see you here, Walter. For a long time, and you're absolutely right. The Menzies story, I think, is a fantastic story about taking a party back to the base, although he did take a fairly radical approach to it, of course. I think the starting point is for the majority and the vast majority of the party to recognise that we have to do this now. There is a short window. This is an unusual circumstance. Right? We have state and federal elections coming within a few months of each other. One of the reasons given for not acting straight away on this over the years has been, gee, we've got an election coming. Just wait until after the election. Well, you know what? We've got 3 years. We've got 3 years. It's like a solar eclipse. It's a very unusual circumstance. We get a window, and if we don't act now, then I think not only do we risk electoral oblivion in the future, if it's not the next election will be soon up, because we can't harness and mobilise our base, I think we don't. It'll be much harder to find an opportunity to do this. So this is a very, very unique opportunity, and I'm confident that good people who stand up, and there are many good people in this room, can make this happen.
Going back to Menzies, he really did do it, though, by founding a new party.
I do understand that.
And I'm not a member of the Liberal Party, but if I look at history, as I occasionally do, the strongest the strongest moment for the Liberal Party, I would say, in my lifetime, I was born the year Menzies won, was probably when John Howard won in 1996 and stood with a line of women that went zigzagging like that. And it didn't happen overnight, and Peter Seaton can tell us an awful lot about how it did happen. And it didn't happen because there were targets, and it didn't happen because there were quotas. But what I saw in the pre-selections over the last couple of years of the Liberal Party was every time a woman retired, a young man took her spot, for good or bad reasons. The Liberal Party really is starting to look like a bloke's club. How are you going to change that?
Look, and maybe I'm betraying the strength of my liberal conservative principles and beliefs. I firmly believe that if you decentralise power, markets and democracies drive the right outcomes. You know, I've seen this in my business career. You know, there is nothing that has done more for affirmative action than tough, contested markets. If you look at the market for great people for professional services firms, you know, they're hiring more than 50% women these days. Why? Because they're just wanting to hire the best people. And why do they need to do that? Because they compete ferociously. And I think it's that sense, that belief we have in decentralisation of power, in markets, in democracies, that is our best shot at getting the best people, male or female or whatever colour and creed and so on, that's how we'll do it. There is no shortage, by the way, of really wonderful academic research on the impact of tough, contested markets and democracies for driving good outcomes, and you know, we need to get back to having a real faith in that.
Second last question.
I've recently joined the Liberal Party, the first party I've ever belonged to, and I'm not sure how it operates. Does it have a state conference, an annual state conference, at which you could mobilise?
Yeah. So I've deliberately avoided getting into the mechanics of all of this, which are of great interest to members of the Liberal Party, I know, and is an important discussion to have. I think the starting point, though, for change is to be very clear about why, about what, and about when. Now, there is a question about how, and that's a question which, you know, I know others will continue to think about, but... you know, there are many mechanisms within the Liberal Party to achieve change, and it's important we drive that. So,
he's joined the party on something that has a state conference. I think the answer is yes.
Yes, it does.
Yes, it does. Yes, okay. Final question. You've recently been promoted. I mean, is it good fun being Assistant Minister for Cities and Digital Transformation? What are you on about there, very briefly?
Yeah, well, it is actually. I mean, they're both great areas, so... When we look at cities, the real focus is on better investment in our cities, is what it really comes down to, using better technology and driving reform. Now, traditionally, the federal government has been an automatic teller machine for the states when it comes to investment in our cities. We wait until the political pressure winds up, and then we hand over some money for a piece of infrastructure which we've spent almost no time evaluating, thinking about whether it's right or shaping. And this is about changing the nature of that relationship as we invest in our cities. We have done this more reasonably recently with our investment in WestConnex, which is a loan, it's not a grant. And we're in the process of looking at doing similar things in a range of other places. So it's a very different approach to the way we invest in our cities. With digital, look, the great challenge of modern Western governments is how to deliver efficient, competent government. And I can tell you that we have all seen in the private sector, efficient, competent businesses are making more and more clever use of technology. If government is not using technology, we can't possibly proselytise to the private sector to innovate. We have to innovate first and foremost, and I see enormous opportunity for us to be more efficient and more competent through use of technology. That's what I'm focused on.
Many thanks. Thanks to Angus Taylor for what I think will come to be regarded as a very important speech at an important time in the history of the Liberal Party. So I was very grateful that Angus Taylor could do it at the Sydney Institute. We'll have you back sometime to talk about your role in cities and digital transformation, but this is an important topic tonight. When I introduced the point, the speaker, I made the point that
two of the four leaders who led the Liberal Party to victory from opposition, John Howard and Tony Abbott. It's important to remember, I think, that both John Howard and Tony Abbott won quite contested pre-selections against Goodfield some years before the current situation has developed. Michael Baum never learns. He's been interjecting since he joined the Parliament. But I'm not taking any interjections, and I'm just saying to Angus Taylor, thanks for a great job tonight, and best wishes in what you're trying to do. Thank you.